Welcome to the second session of the class on the pursuit of happiness. Are you feeling better now? Are you already getting happier? We've reached our second session. The topic for tonight is harmony. Tonight we are going to talk about first Plato and then Lao Tzu. One of the most enduring notions of the good life is the idea that it's somehow harmonious. And harmony is a metaphor ultimately taken from music. But it's an extremely rich metaphor because it manages to incorporate within itself a lot of the characteristics of the good life. First of all, if you have a well-tuned instrument, let's think of a stringed instrument, that's the usual model, is the lyre or sometimes the bow. Things with strings, they work because of certain internal tensions, and these internal tensions can be manipulated in certain ways. And by manipulating internal tensions, you create some kind of optimal arrangement which produces beautiful sounds. Or if you're talking about a bow, can propel arrows into the hide of your enemies. But the idea of harmony involves somehow exploitation of an internal tension to create some good condition. And I think we have to keep that notion in mind of tension as being involved with notions of harmony, in some sense. First, I want to talk about Plato and just a little excerpt from the Republic, because they're taken out of a very large book, and they don't have a lot of context to them, even though the person who edited the collection from which I copied these selections tries to provide some of the context. Plato's Republic, well, it's been read throughout all of history since it was written, and misunderstood in virtually every possible way. The most fundamental misunderstanding of the Republic is that it's a book about politics. It's really not a book about politics, if being a book about something, it means that it's there simply to illuminate political reality. Plato doesn't bring in the political at all in the Republic as an end in itself. He brings it in to illustrate the nature of the soul, the harmony of the soul. So the political is used in the Republic simply as an analogy for illustrating the internal structure of the individual soul. And by the time the book comes to an end, we return to the theme of the soul and its proper harmony, and the political is pretty much dismissed. And so we have to just sort of bracket anything you might have heard about Plato's political philosophy that might be based on the Republic, because the Republic isn't a book about politics, it's a book about the soul. Plato did write a book later in his life called The Laws, or Nomoi, which is a book about politics. He also wrote another dialogue, The Statesman, which tries to deal with the nature of the statesman. And the things that they teach about the political are very different from the things you find in the Republic, because the Republic isn't about politics. Now, at the beginning of the Republic, the question is raised, what is justice? And justice seems preeminently to be a political virtue. The Greek word for justice has two meanings, one of which is a properly political meaning, and the other of which is not properly political. Aristotle, in his Ethics, draws out this distinction nicely. The Greek word that's being translated as justice here, well, it's dike. And when it's treated as a characteristic of the soul is a virtue, it's dikai osune. What does it mean? Well, you can translate dike, justice, or right, as in right and wrong. And the notion of right and wrong is a broader concept than the concept of justice, which refers specifically to the political, general. Or if not to the political, at least dealings with others. But not all of your moral decisions involve dealings with others. They're dealings with yourself. And you can be right or wrong in your dealings with yourself. Okay, so the notion of right has a broader sense. The notion of justice has a broader sense than just political justice or interpersonal relationships. It brings in the notion of right in the broadest possible sense, namely the moral. And when you talk about a just person, you can translate this term again, just, like he's a just man, right? But you can also translate it in a more broad sense, if you will, as righteous. Let's say, the justness of a person, or the righteousness of a person. Okay, that's what it refers to. And I use righteousness just because it preserves the word right in it. But when you talk about a righteous person, the term is often used as a term of abuse when you talk about extremely righteous people. But the primary sense is certainly not a term of abuse at all. It really is a term denoting some kind of comprehensive moral perfection. You know, the righteous man or the righteous individual is a really good person all around. The topic of justice is immediately discussed in a political context in the Republic. But slowly, the meaning of the term modulates and changes to refer to the most comprehensive sense of justice of all, which is righteousness, which means basically all the virtues together. Whereas in the narrow sense of justice, it's just, or being just, it's just one virtue, one among many. When you talk about he's just in his dealings with his clients or something like that, that's a narrow sense of justice. And a person who just might have many other virtues and vices besides that. But when you talk about a person as a righteous individual, you're referring to all of their virtues together, and you're saying implicitly that they have few or no vices that can compromise that. So we need to keep this in mind. The whole Republic begins with the notion of justice narrowly considered and immediately moves to this notion of righteousness in the broadest sense, which means comprehensive virtue. Just all around goodness. Now, in Book 2 of the Republic, what you find is Socrates is having a conversation with two young men who are brothers of Plato, actually, Glaucon and Adamantus. And Glaucon and Adamantus mount an extremely powerful challenge to Socrates to show that justice is profitable, justice is to our benefit. And the first little passage is Glaucon laying out one of the commonly held views about justice, namely that justice is not anything that's good by nature. In fact, injustice is good by nature. Why? Well, because what's natural is to have wants and desires, right? And the natural thing to do when you desire something is to satisfy that desire. Unfortunately, sometimes the things that you desire belong to somebody else, right? So you have to go and you grab them, you get them, you have to satisfy yourself. And so, if you live in accordance with your nature and your natural desires, the proper thing to do is to be unjust. But the fact of the matter is, though, that people realize that suffering injustice is far more likely than getting away with injustice. And so the broad majority of people get together and they decide to prohibit injustice because they figure that if you balance out justice, the injustices they get away with against the injustices they suffer, it's better just to prohibit injustice altogether. And so we have a kind of social contract to get rid of injustice. But that doesn't mean that injustice is a bad thing. Injustice is just, it's a good thing by nature. We all want to be bad. We're better off being naughty, getting our way in every certain circumstance. But we can't do it in the context of society. And so Glaucon offers a story to illustrate how this is actually the case, that we're only just because of the fact that society makes it worth our while by punishing us if we're unjust. He says, but what if you had a ring that would make you invisible, and therefore invisible to the eyes of the law, and would therefore allow you to get away with injustice with impunity? Imagine if you had that ring. Would you do justice, given that there are no external incentives that could be brought to bear on you to force you to do the just thing? Now just think about it for a while. Imagine that part of the fee for the course was to provide you with rings of Gyges, rings to make you invisible. Would you break any laws if you could get away with it, with impunity?
For the same price, of course?
Well, you know, it's included. It's included.
Okay,
I'll pass them out. But then imagine you have that ring on your little finger or whatever finger you want. Would you continue all to be law-abiding citizens? Presuming, of course, that you are law-abiding citizens to begin with, would you all continue to be law-abiding citizens? Can I have a show of hands? Who would be naughtier if they could be invisible and get away with it? I'm afraid, you know, I thought about it for a long time, and I thought, you know, Tower Records would be just emptied out if I could be invisible. There are all these CDs that'd be floating out the door. The fact is that there are many strong temptations to do injustice, that if the disincentive of punishment is removed, these things will happen. And so Glaucon thinks that this is sufficient proof that injustice is naturally good, and that it's only by convention, by law, that it becomes a bad thing. But if invisibility can make you immune to conventions and laws, then there would be more injustice in the world, because that's the way of nature. Well, you know, if we could define justice, we wouldn't be doing this. There's this fellow who used to come to the Philosophy Cafe, and I assume will still continue to do so, even though I will not, who would always, whenever some topic was brought up, would immediately insist that we define it. Well, define that term. And I just thought, you know, this is putting the cart before the horse, because if you knew a definition of, say, justice, you wouldn't need philosophy. You could just look it up in the textbook. And part of what the philosophical problem is to come up with some adequate account of it. So we can't do that up front. If we could do it up front, we wouldn't have to philosophize. And so in part what philosophizing is groping your way towards some kind of adequate understanding. And that involves just going through a lot of confused talk and then realizing you're confused and trying to refine what you're saying. So it's hard to define justice up front. But I mean, you can give examples, you know, fair dealing, paying people what they owe, giving back things that you borrow, things like that. Those would be small sort of retail acts of justice, right? And that's how the Republic starts out, with the definition that justice is respecting property relationships. That turns out to be inadequate to capture what we all know justice to be. And the reason why we don't need the definition at the beginning, and this is the Platonic thesis, which is very, very controversial, is this. Socrates would say, you already know what justice is, so you don't need a definition. In fact, you can only get a definition by virtue of the fact that you already know it. And what the search for a definition is an attempt to put into words something that you already know in a kind of inarticulate, tacit way. And that, for instance, if I were to define justice as it's defined at the beginning of the Republic as respecting property relationships, Socrates would say, well, wait a second, Greg. What if somebody loans you a gun? It's their gun. They own it lawfully. And they say, I'll loan you my gun on the condition that whenever I need it, you return it to me immediately upon that request. And you say, sure, it's a deal. Shake hands. And then suddenly the person shows up to you and says, I need my gun back. I'm going to go on a killing spree. Imagine it's Mark Barton, right? His day trading has gone bad, and he wants his gun back. And Socrates said, well, would it be just to give the gun back, given that he wants to go on a killing spree? No, obviously not. But how can you say that? What gives you the right to say that's obviously unjust? The only way that you can really say that that account of justice is obviously inadequate is if you already have a better account of justice. But where is it? Well, it's in you already, right? It just hasn't achieved words yet. It hasn't been spoken. It hasn't been articulated. And it's precisely by putting forward inadequate definitions and then subjecting them to criticism and then going back and trying to formulate your inner intuitions about what justice is better that you get closer and closer to the definition. But you already know. It's just a matter of coming to know what you know. That's the way that the Platonic dialectic works. Now, back to the story in the Republic. Glaucon, you know, basically says, look, if you had the ring of invisibility, you would do injustice, which indicates that justice is purely conventional and injustice is the natural thing to do. Now, his brother Adamantus, who's not quoted in here, goes on and he gives another example, which is even more difficult to deal with. He says, what about the man who is really unjust but has an impeccable reputation for justice? Meaning that he's an evil thief and an SOB and a liar and a cheat, but you just can't convince anybody of it. And so he rises to the very heights of society. He becomes extremely powerful and so forth, doing injustice all the while and pretending to be a good man. Is this fellow better off or worse off than a person who's the exact opposite, namely a person who really is just but has a terrible reputation for injustice and is persecuted and hated and reviled, and Adamantus describes him being blinded and crucified by the end of the whole ordeal, because although he's really just, he's gotten this improper reputation for injustice. Which man is better off? Who's better off? I tread dangerously. Who's better off, President Clinton or Kenneth Starr? President Clinton is a person who's probably, well, I'm quite certain of it, is a rather unjust and unscrupulous fellow, and yet it's very hard to convince people of it. Whereas his special prosecutor apparently hasn't done anything wrong in his life. No one seems to have been able to find that. You know, they tried to accuse him of wrongdoing, and they've certainly been digging, and nothing's come to light. And yet he's got this this terrible reputation. He's been given this terrible reputation by the president's apologists. The worst they can say is that he was a lawyer for the tobacco industry. And that's about it. Yet, who's better off? Who's the happier man, Adamantus asks. And Socrates really has a problem at that point. He's got to prove that somebody who's really just, but is given all the punishments of injustice, is actually better off, has greater well-being, than a person who's really unjust, but is given all the benefits and rewards of justice. And that's a really tall task. That's very hard. And the entire republic is devoted to arguing that the just man is better off, even though he might be persecuted and killed. You get this in Isaiah, to the suffering servant of the Lord, and so forth. This is a perennial theme. You know, how in the world do you justify being a good human being, given that evil people, fat, cigar-chomping devils, drive around in limousines and gain power and wealth and fame and fortune, even though they're wicked, whereas perfectly decent people are left choking in the dust? This fellow I knew who was born in Chile, he told me that the Chileans that he knew actually told him once that part of the pleasure of having a big, nice car is precisely racing through poor neighborhoods and raising great clouds of dust and scattering people and chickens in your path. That's part of the fun of it. And I was just thinking, you know, there is no God when I heard that. But it raises questions, right? And it's a very difficult task to justify being just and saying that being just benefits you, given the very irrational and unjust way that people are rewarded on the basis of their character and their behavior in society. And so what Socrates has to do is he has to prove that justice is advantageous, even if they put your eyes out and nail you to a cross. And he literally talks about crucifixion. And how does he do this? Well, the only possible way that justice could be beneficial to you, if you're stripped of everything and punished, is if justice is something internal. If justice is something that's part of the soul, or internal to the soul, then you can argue that a person who suffers all the external punishments of injustice is still better off if he's really just, because he has to be really just inside, in the invisible part of our nature, right, which would be the soul. And so what Socrates begins to do is he says, well, we need to illuminate the nature of the soul and how justice resides in it, but the soul is hard to see, invisible, and it's very small. So let's use something bigger and easier to see to illustrate the nature of the soul and justice in the soul, and that thing is the city. And so he begins to talk about politics, but only as a way of illustrating the inner nature of the soul. And what he tries to do is he tries to draw an analogy between justice in the political sense, right, the narrow sense of justice that you find in a city, and justice in the soul, which would be righteousness. Justice in the broad sense, which would be a kind of internal, comprehensive virtue, right? And the argument is basically this. The soul is divided into parts, for Plato. And his argument for this is fairly simple and elegant. He argues that the fact that human beings seem to have conflicting motivations indicates that there are different parts of the soul that are pulling in different directions. And he says that there are three parts of the soul: reason, what he calls spirit, and desire. Now, reason is interested in things like the truth, whereas spirit is concerned with things like honor, and desire is directed towards the necessities of life. The different parts of the soul, he argues, can be made analogous to different classes in a city. And he argues that the people who work in the productive economy are analogous to the desiring part of the soul. Because the economy is ruled by demand, consumer demand, desire. The people who work in the economy to produce things for the demands that are there are servants of the desires. Okay? So the analogy works fairly well. He says, well, what in society would be an analogous to the spirited part of the soul, the part of the soul that's concerned with honor? I mean, what would be? Specifically, he calls them the guardian class, which would include the police and the soldiers. And if you go to, you know, somebody who's in the military, they'll explain to you why honor is an important thing. That's part of what they're taught. They're taught to have a sense of honor. Some branches of the military are more concerned with this than others. The Marines talk about preferring death to dishonor, which means that honor is more important than life itself to people who really believe this. And so the guardian class of a society, the class of a society that has to get angry over things and fight over things like right and wrong, would be equivalent to the part of the soul that gets upset about issues of honor or responds passionately to ideals. And then the part of the city that corresponds to reason in the soul is, for Plato, well, ultimately it's going to be a society where philosophers are kings. That's the most extraordinary proposal of the Republic. The most hyperbolic and absurd proposal in the Republic is that philosophers should become kings. But it's not an unreasonable view in this sense. We all want to be ruled by people who are wiser than us. Even democracies, even vigorously, zealously egalitarian democracies, and certainly the United States has to be one of the most zealously egalitarian societies in the world today. Maybe the Australians are a little more that way than we are. In the United States, we still elect our leaders. And what an undemocratic thing that is when you think about it. What would be the most democratic way of choosing leaders? The way that's premised on the idea that there really are no fundamentally important differences between people. Because it's quite elitist when you think about it to have this system of election. Because people are competing to see who's the best candidate. What would be a far juster way of choosing leaders if we really believe that there are no important differences between the quality of different people? Do it by lottery, exactly. This is the way the ancient Greek democracies worked. Offices were filled by drawing lots. Exactly, and look at where that's gotten us. But we do have a serious problem in the United States with juries, and they seem to be getting worse every year. Part of that has to do with the fact that in the past there were more stringent requirements for being voters, and therefore more stringent requirements for being jurors. And now as technology becomes more complicated and science becomes more and more relevant to trials, we find that we have fewer and fewer people who are qualified to deal with the complexities of arguments sitting on juries. And that's a serious problem. But if we were really a truly egalitarian society, we wouldn't elect leaders. We would simply choose them by lot. But the fact that we have an electoral system implies in some way that we think some people are better than others, and that it's desirable to find people who are better than average to lead. There was a senator, I think he was a Southern senator, during the Nixon administration. There was a controversy about a Supreme Court nominee that Nixon made that was considered to be a rather inferior candidate. And the senator said, well, you know, most voters are mediocre. I don't see why we shouldn't have somebody mediocre on the Supreme Court. And he was roundly laughed at and denounced for that. And yet the fact is that he's far more egalitarian in that thinking than most people. The idea that the wise should rule is not so far-fetched when we think about even the behavior of people in democracies who are zealous about preserving their rights. We generally, in the household, find, usually in households, we find that the parents rule the children. Usually. Not always. Why would that seem to be a reasonable thing? Well, because on average, there are certain exceptions, but on average, parents are wiser than their children. And that's why it's only appropriate that the parents should rule. Of course, you know, there's a cutoff date when that's no longer true, and convincing parents that that time has come is always, it's always been a perennial problem. But the fact is that on average, parents are wiser than children. And so the claim that reason should rule in the city is not bad. It's not unjustifiable. And by going through the different classes of the city and laying out the way a society should work best, Socrates basically comes to this conclusion. Reason should rule, in the form of philosophers, wise people. They should convey their orders to the guardians of public order, people who fight for the city, who are willing to give up their lives over issues like honor, and that these people will keep order among the desiring class, or the desire-driven, desire-ruled class, namely the people who work in the economy as a whole. And if this can be justified as an account of the nature of a well-ordered society, then let's apply this again to the soul, which is what we're trying to illuminate to begin with. Plato would argue that the well-ordered soul would be a soul that is ruled by reason, or wisdom. The rational part of the soul, which pursues wisdom, will rule it. The spirited part of the soul, one's sense of honor, will be ruled by reason, but it in turn will be used as a kind of auxiliary to reason in order to rule over the passions. So an example would be something like this. Plato gives examples like this about internal conflicts to try and illustrate that there are different parts of the soul. So imagine a person who has a drinking problem, and they come in out of a hot day in the yard, or something like that, and somebody plunks down in front of them a tall pint of cold beer. Now, their desires are likely going to be saying, drink, drink. However, it might be the case that at the same time that they will be pulled toward the beer to drink it, they will also find themselves pulled away from the beer by some other force inside them. For instance, their reason might be saying, look, you've gone through the 12-step program. You know all of the ins and outs of this. You know why you shouldn't do this. And the rational part of the soul will be saying no, whereas the desiring part of the soul will be saying yes. And the fact that the soul is pushing and pulling in two opposite directions indicates that it has two opposed, distinct forces within it. This is how he argues that the soul is broken up into parts. Reason might employ as a kind of auxiliary in calming the desires an appeal to pride as well, or an appeal to one's spiritedness or one's sense of honor. You might say, wait a second here. In addition to the fact that you know it's wrong, it's bad for you, think about all the things that you've done when you were out of control. Think about the times you fell down in the gutter and busted your head. Think about all the people you made passes at that you shouldn't have made passes at. Remember the time when you woke up in Alabama 2 days later. You're above all this. You're better than this. You're better than your desires. And by appealing to that sense of pride, that's another way of pulling away from the beer or whatever, and calming and ruling the desires. Now, there can be conflicts between reason and pride, too. Say that you're walking down a street one day, and some maniac swerves to splash a lot of muddy water on you. This actually happened to me once. I was furious. It had rained, and there were big puddles on the street, and I was walking down the street, on the sidewalk, minding my own business, and I swear, this maniac swerved to cast huge waves of muddy water all over me. Fortunately, I wasn't too bad damaged by the whole thing. But imagine if somebody did that to you, and you're really angry, and you're going to give them a strip off of their hide, and you see them pull up down the street, and you're running towards them, and you're going to give them a piece of your mind, and suddenly the person gets out of the car, and they're this sort of huge, threatening, gorilla-like creature. Now, at that point, your pride is saying, murder the bastard, you know, at least tell him off, whereas your reason, your prudence is saying, well, maybe you've only got one death, and maybe this is not the best way of using it up. And so you have this internal conflict, which indicates that there are two parts of the soul, each pulling in opposite directions. They're distinct. That distinction is the basis for the fact that they can be in conflict with one another. This kind of argument, I think, is quite convincing that there are different faculties or parts of the soul. And the clearest way of showing that there are distinct faculties is to find situations in which they are in conflict, in which one part is pushing towards something while another part is pulling away from it. The question is this, couldn't you sort of give an account of human behavior like someone like Hume, who basically talks about how you have different desires and reason sort of is a calculating faculty that orders desires in certain ways. Socrates actually talks about this view in the Phaedo, and he calls it the view of self-control through self-indulgence. The person who says, you shouldn't get drunk. Why? because you know, that's a short-run self-indulgence, and it might foreclose the possibility of certain long-term indulgences that you might weigh as more desirable. Well, that's possible, and human beings behave like that. Specifically, modern human beings are much more like that than other people. But what Hume is consciously doing, and what most of the early modern philosophers are consciously trying to do, is they're trying to simplify our conception of ourselves by eliminating the middle part of the soul, the spirited part of the soul, and by reconfiguring or reordering reason as something that is not a faculty that finds satisfaction simply in knowing truths as ends in and of themselves, but as something which is a merely calculative faculty which orders and helps the desires to satisfy themselves. So the clearest sign of this transformation of the nature of reason is the transformation of the nature or of our understanding of science. Before the Renaissance, and even after the Renaissance in some quarters, the idea that was that science was a purely contemplative or speculative activity, and that to cultivate one's capacity to know things was a kind of excellence which was worthwhile in and of itself. There were certain satisfactions simply in knowing. And there's truth to that. There's a certain pleasure simply in understanding things. Now, there are lots of mundane and boring little things that I can't imagine anyone taking pleasure in understanding. But that explains why ancient science was so limited in some ways. Because if science was treated as a kind of end in itself, a purely contemplative activity to be pursued of its own accord, you wouldn't get modern science, which spends a lot of time and a lot of energy studying very little things, which are really of no intrinsic interest at all. There are people out there who spend their entire lives making tiny, minute measurements of nematodes and studying nematodes in the Scottish Highlands. That's a whole career could be made in that. There's nothing intrinsically interesting about that, and although these people might find pleasure in it. But the fact is that the reason why modern science generally goes is that it is always connected with some kind of technological benefit. Science as an activity in modernity is justified and encouraged primarily because it promises certain technological benefits, extrinsic rewards. And what kind of rewards? Well, rewards that will help us to satisfy our desires better. You find in early modernity that the main thing that got in the way of the reconfiguring of the order of the soul, if you will, was this part, the spirited part, or the honor-driven part. Why? Well, because traditionally societies have been ruled by people who are primarily concerned with issues of honor, rank, prestige. Most wars in the past were fought over things like honor, prestige, things like that. They were not fought over ideologies, which is a very modern thing. Part of the transformation of the world that modernity has inaugurated has been the emergence of popular regimes that are not ruled by aristocracies, but are ruled by the masses, who represent the desiring element in Plato's Republic. And mass democracies, mass societies, are desire-driven societies. They're consumer-driven societies. Now, the main impediment to the emergence of that were ancient aristocratic orders. And so this part of the soul was consciously mocked by the founders of the world we live in. So, for instance, chivalry was dealt an absolutely crushing blow by Cervantes and Don Quixote. It was just a vicious mockery of chivalry, which discredited it widely in the minds of generations, well, ever since. If you look at somebody like Hume said that reason is and always ought to be a slave of the passions. And he despised people that he thought were contentious and quarrelsome and concerned with mere specious issues like honor, family, dynasty, class, things like that. Thomas Hobbes argued that reason is to the desires as scouts and spies. The purpose of reason is to act as a kind of scout and a spy to help bring about the triumph of the desires, like scouts and spies bring about the triumph of generals in wars, right? But the desires rule. Locke talked about how we have to secure the rights of the industrious and rational. Industrious meaning the people who work in the economy, and they're rational precisely in their industriousness. And who do we have to secure the rights against? Against the contentious and quarrelsome. And who are they? Well, these people who are fighting duels and things like that. These honor-driven types. And so what happened with modernity, and Hume is a perfect example of this, he's quite clear about what he's up to, is an attempt to simplify our self-understanding, and in such a way that we pretty much eliminate this dimension of the human personality from consideration, and to the extent that we even think about it, we think about it as somehow quaint and absurd, and just as more of a source of trouble. Whereas pre-modern societies and non-Westernized societies are still almost entirely centered around issues of honor. We ignore that at our own peril, in a sense, because we really don't understand non-Western societies, or most of human history, for that matter, unless we recognize that this part of the soul really has a nature, and that you can understand most of human history as an expression of spiritedness in one way or another, trying to satisfy itself. And of course, Hegel, who really is one of my favorite philosophers, understands all of human history as in some way a long process whereby human beings come to self-awareness, but the process is driven by spiritedness, by competitiveness. And Plato basically argues the same thing. For the origin of distinctly human forms of life and the origin of history from prehistory has everything to do with the emergence of people who are primarily dominated by motivations of honor. Because this is the first thing about us, historically speaking, that separates us from animals. Pre-modern man, or prehistoric man, was basically, in his view, a slightly more clever ape than the other apes. Because we did have this tool-making facility that was reason in a technical, instrumental sense was there. And man today is a far more intelligent ape, in some sense. We're far more facile in the satisfaction of our desires. But the distinctly human capacity to dedicate ourselves to ideals, and honor is just the idea of oneself that we have, right? When we get upset, when we feel disrespected, that means that we hold up an idea we have of ourselves as a standard by which we judge how others treat us, and we feel flattered and gratified when they treat us in a way that fits in with that notion of our self-worth, or we feel dishonored and disrespected if they treat us in a way that doesn't satisfy that. So the honor is a kind of idealism. It's kind of self-centered idealism at the beginning, but it's the basis for it can be broadened and developed into the most non-self-centered idealism that possibly can be. And there are people who are willing to die over issues of honor, which is very interesting because one of the central ideas of modern society is the idea that we have an instinct for survival, self-interest, saving ourselves. This is one of the central assumptions about human behavior that you find in most modern people, that the instinct to preserve one's life, to keep oneself in existence, is the strongest thing, where it's really not. And it hasn't been throughout most of history. And the people who have been primarily concerned with self-preservation were always regarded as slavish, somehow inferior to the people who were willing to, under certain circumstances, to give up their lives over ideas or ideals or just bad points of honor, people who are willing to fight duels and things like that. Plato would say, and this is a long answer to a short question, I know, but Plato would say, look, someone like Hume is extremely clever, but there's an agenda here, and the agenda involves the creation of a different kind of world, a different kind of city, if you will, right? And to have a different kind of city, we have to have a different kind of soul. And the city we live in is a city ruled by desire, where reason is understood as merely technical and instrumental. And in order to have that kind of world come into existence, and it certainly has come into existence, they had to simplify our understanding of ourselves and rewire the soul in a way to place desire as the sovereign part of the soul, to make spiritedness something that is either to be ignored or channeled into things like economic competitiveness, the spirit of enterprise, things like that. That's safe. and to treat reason as a merely instrumental faculty. Whereas the republic Plato talks about, or the city that Plato talks about, is a city that is founded on and mirrors a different kind of soul, one that's primarily ordered by reason, and specifically by wisdom, not merely technical or instrumental cleverness, like reason is usually understood today, but by the pursuit of wisdom, which encourages, to some extent, our spiritedness, because it recognizes that this kind of idealism is absolutely necessary if we're going to attain self-control, meaning control over our desires, and regards desire as something that is implicitly extremely destructive of the soul, if it is not measured and moderated. And so the Greeks were enormously interested in virtues of moderation and self-control. Why? Because they recognized that the easiest way towards the complete dissolution of the personality, the moral personality, was to simply have no capacity to control one's desires. And we all recognize that on some level in the training of children. We impose orders on children. Children are born with chaotic desires, and we impose feeding schedules and things on them. Some parents are more regimented than others. Some nannies are fanatics. So, you know, the classic English nanny, you know, they were fanatical about trying to impose order on everything, from, you know, making children go to the bathroom at the same time every day, things like that. The basis of that, once desires can be mastered, that provides the foundation for having a more orderly development of the higher faculties of the soul. Whereas people who simply can't focus their minds, you can't learn. You can't develop the higher faculties of the soul unless there's some kind of order that's imposed upon the lower faculty, the faculty of desire. There is a three-level analogy here. There's the city and the soul, and there are the virtues. In the city, there is the philosopher king who rules, the guardians who guard and enforce the law, and the workers who are part of the economy. In the soul, there is reason, which is directed towards, again, truth. Spirit, which is oriented towards ideals and honor. And finally, desire, which is directed towards the necessities of life. This directedness is what Plato calls eros, or love. It's the striving of the soul towards its completion. And it's completed by different things because it has different parts with different needs. There are virtues that are associated with the different parts of the city and the different parts of the soul. The Greeks talked about the four cardinal virtues. And the four cardinal virtues are wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice. And what they do is they go through this analogy between the city and the soul, and they say, well, okay, where in the city and where in the soul would you find wisdom, which is the highest and most important virtue? Well, you find that in the philosopher king in the city and in reason in the soul, right? This is where you find the virtue of wisdom. Where do you find the virtue of courage? Well, that would be something that the guardians would have in the city, primarily, and that the spirited part of the soul would be the residence of. What about moderation? Well, moderation has to be, in a sense, imposed upon the desires. So moderation would be directed towards the working class, the productive class of the city, and towards the desires of the soul. And moderation is imposed from the top down by wisdom allied with courage, imposing moderation upon the desires. And then the question is, okay, well, where does justice fit into this picture? And where would it fit in? Justice consists in the city of each class doing its work. So the rulers rule, the guardians guard, and the workers work. That's what justice is. And each class does its work because, ultimately, the order flows down from the top, right? Everybody minding his own business, Plato says, is justice. It's everyone doing their own job. And in soul, justice consists of minding one's own business. Each part of the soul does its business, meaning that each part of the soul, specifically each part perfected by virtue, plays its role. So the desires are moderate, and the spirit is courageous, and reason becomes wise, and they all work together harmoniously, and this is what justice is in the soul. Now, justice in the city is this merely political sense of justice, right? Whereas justice in the soul is more than just political. It's this comprehensive notion of virtue, or righteousness, is what we're talking about. We're talking about the morally perfected individual. The morally perfected person is a person who has a soul in which each part works together harmoniously with the others, and all of them unfold their potentialities over time in this harmonious fashion. So Plato argues that if a person has a soul like this, they have achieved happiness. Well-being is simply the proper internal ordering of the soul, and nothing else. And it's intrinsically good. It's something that's worthy of choice for its own sake. One doesn't pursue happiness or well-being for anything else beyond it. When somebody says, you know, I realize today I'm happy, you don't say, well, what good is that going to do you? I'm sure there are some people who would say that. Well, yes, you're happy, but what good is that? It's not good for anything. It's just good in and of itself. Now, ideally, Socrates says, our virtues should not just be intrinsically good for us and worthy of choice in and of themselves. They should also be useful. So courage is something that is best if it's useful, right? Moderation, if it's useful, is even better. But the usefulness is just a kind of added extra. It's a kind of bonus. Because these things are choice-worthy in and of themselves, even if they are of no use to you whatsoever. And, even more strongly, even if you're punished for them, they're still good for you. This is the task that he has to prove. He has to prove that virtue is intrinsically good. If it's going to be intrinsically good, it has to be internal to the soul. How can justice, righteousness, be intrinsically good if it's an internal thing? It has to have something to do with the proper internal ordering of the soul. And he uses the model of harmony to explain this. It's a musical model. And musical education is enormously important for Socrates. Now, those of us who love music in all of its guises would find Socrates and Plato's views of music to be extremely austere. Basically, as one commentator put it, Socrates was sort of like the guy, the Englishman, who thought there were two kinds of songs. There was the national anthem, and then there was everything that wasn't the national anthem. And as it turns out, for Plato, most of the music that he thinks is healthy is very simple. It's John Philip Sousa to get people marching, and then some nice stuff to get them relaxed at the end of the day. But nothing too sensuous, nothing too disturbing. Of course, you know, the Greeks had very simple musical instruments. They did not have the modern symphony orchestra. But the modern symphony, if Plato were to be a music critic today, I think he would be deeply disturbed by romanticism, for instance. You know, stirs up all the dark emotions of the soul. I think he would be all for classicism, baroque music, and so forth. It's orderly, harmonious. You know, Schoenberg, I think, Wagner would have driven him absolutely mad. It is the ordering itself. For Plato, it's the ordering itself.
Harmonious ordering.
Yeah. For someone like Aristotle, it would be the outcome. Aristotle defines the virtues as acquired capacities to attain well-being, meaning that they're not the same as well-being. Whereas someone like Plato, or later the Stoics, would say that the virtues are well-being, such that you never have to have any of the external things that Aristotle thinks are necessary. Aristotle is big on equipment. He says to attain well-being, you have to have certain equipment. You have to have a nice house and a nice family and nice things to look at, some pretty paintings on the walls, nice rugs under your feet, so on and so forth. He was notoriously foppish. He liked expensive clothes and wore lots of jewelry and spoke with a lisp, which gives you a sort of Liberace-like image, which conflicts with the
with the voice you hear in his actual writings, which are very austere. And of course, Plato was quite wealthy and lived a life of leisure. But Socrates was quite poor, walked around barefoot most of the time. And as far as he was concerned, this was in no way an impediment to his well-being. And Socrates would basically say to someone like Aristotle, if you recognize that in some level the virtues consist of the health of the soul, that this is what well-being is. And Aristotle would in some way have to grant that, that to have virtue is to already have a well-ordered soul. Even though these virtues will give you the capacity to use the things, the equipment that you have well to redound to your happiness, the virtues will also allow you not to use these things or to forego these things and still be happy. Socrates would say to him, but Aristotle, aren't you giving hostages to fortune? Aren't you investing yourself a lot in external things? If wisdom allows me to be happy wandering around barefoot in the snow, it would also apparently allow Socrates to make good use of wealth and nice things and so forth. But given that these things are somewhat indifferent to one's happiness, his argument is just throw them overboard. You don't need them, because the more invested you are in external things, the more hostages you give to fortune, because fortune can never be eliminated from human life. Luck is always out there, including bad luck, and the more you're invested in external things, the more bad luck can simply wipe you out, right?